This was one man, midlife, losing his shit. Chapter 23. Ruby couldn't believe it. The SAT class was 10 minutes underway, and she was sitting in the back row alone. Harry had ditched the class, and she hadn't, and faking another stomach flu would have made the Queen Dork call her mother's for sure. She sat with her bag on the seat to her left and her jean jacket on the seat to her right, just in case anyone got any ideas about sitting too close. Rebecca smiled and waved, and Eliza and Thayer made a couple of stink faces her direction, and Ruby ignored them all. She flipped over the first handout, turned similes into smiles, and started drawing Bingo with a superhero cape and a cigarette. The class was interminable. 3 hours of practice tests and tricks for how to answer multiple-choice questions when you didn't know the answer. Ruby had bombed the SAT so efficiently the first time that she thought she could teach the class better than Rebecca. A simple do-the-opposite-of-whatever-I-say methodology, where you got extra points just for not skipping every third question. Tomorrow it would be July, and the class would be half over. She tried to think of it as meditation. Her body had to be in this room, but her mind did not. She tried astral projecting, but found Thayer's gum-chewing too distracting. Ruby filled in bubbles in the shapes of fish eating smaller fish. It wasn't that she was against college, per se. Ruby just felt that the world held too many unique experiences for her to be pinned down to doing one thing for so many years, especially when she'd spent her entire life up until this point doing that exact thing. When was her boxcar jumping period? Her life as a carny. Reality TV and PETA newsletters had spoiled many things, but they couldn't kill her dreams about being a loose woman in the United States of America. What if she wanted to work as a stripper someday? She didn't, but what if? What if she wanted to get ill-conceived tattoos with brand new friends? Ruby had 2 tattoos already. Her mother's knew and didn't even pretend to care. One was a small star in the space between her right armpit and her boob, and the other was a bee for Bingo on her left big toe. Her mom was so jealous of the bee that she got one too, but only because Ruby made her promise that they would never bare their toes at the same time in front of anyone Ruby knew. The kids in the row ahead of her stood up, shoving handouts into their bags. "Fabulous," Ruby said at full volume and followed suit. She waved to Rebecca, gave the finger to Eliza and Thayer, and was the first person out the door. Harry was standing outside, wearing sunglasses. He had a very full tote bag slung on his left shoulder and a beach umbrella leaning against his right.
"Ready, mademoiselle?" he said. "Dirty hipster beach in the Rockaways. I found it on the internet. Taxi's waiting. And by taxi, I mean the subway. It's going to take us 100 years to get there, but I swear to God it'll be worth it."
"For fuck's sake, yes," Ruby said. She raised her arms in victory. Part 2. Jane Says. The Ditmas Park Local Beat. Yoga Evolves on Stratford. Evolvement owner David Goldsmith hadn't spent much time in Ditmas Park before opening his brand new yoga and health center on Stratford Road. "I'd been looking around Brooklyn, mostly in Williamsburg and Bushwick, when a friend tipped me off about this place," he told us. "Like a lot of people, my first thought was, whoa. Evolvement offers yoga classes, massage services, and serves juice and other beverages. Goldsmith says that he's interested in getting involved in the neighborhood, so stop by and check them out. Drop-in classes are $11, cheaper with a class card. We tried a ginger kale apple juice, and it was delicious." Chapter 24. It was more fun than he'd had in years, though fun wasn't precisely the right word. Salome called the dance parties cosmic trances, and they were fucking cosmic, absolutely. Andrew had never been a dancer. In high school, he had occasionally pogoed into his friends in the pit at shows, and at Oberlin, he had grinded his body against beautiful girls with short hair and nose rings when he was fall-down drunk, but he had never really liked to dance. He was far too self-conscious. Zoe was in the dance department, always flinging her body against the wooden floor and calling it choreography. That was how she got all the girls. Elizabeth was more like him, happier to stand against a wall and bob her head, preferably holding a red plastic cup in front of her face so that she could whisper things to whoever was standing next to her. Andrew hadn't realized he was so tired of whispering. At first, when Salome had started playing music, they were all sitting down or giving each other little back massages. Andrew closed his eyes and sat on a pillow in the corner of the room. He wanted to let go of his body, to let go of his mind. He tried talk therapy, but it wasn't for him. You couldn't change anything by sitting in a room with a stranger and telling him your side of the story. Andrew liked interaction and healing from the outside in. The music was interesting, rhythmic and wobbly. He couldn't tell if he was listening to guitars or synths or nothing at all, just some computer-generated tracks made by a kid in his basement, probably the latter. Did anyone even learn how to play an instrument anymore? No, he wasn't going to think about that. He wasn't going to be Clint Eastwood telling kids to get off his lawn, and so Andrew relaxed and waited. It was 3 a.m. when he finally walked out the door. He was soaked with sweat, his own and everyone else's. Evolvement had turned into a greenhouse, all of them their own individual hothouse flower. The air on Stratford Road felt cool and refreshing, just like the glasses of cucumber water that the Evolvers had been passing around and then pouring over one another's heads. Elizabeth was going to be pissed, if not worried. Andrew didn't know which was worse. Worry could remove some of the sting of anger if she was happy to know that he was all right. Of course, he wasn't her child. Why would she assume that something had befallen him? Andrew thought about explaining why he liked Evolvement, but couldn't come up with anything that didn't sound like he was about to start sleeping with a 19-year-old. It wasn't that. Andrew had no interest in having sex with the beautiful young things. There were unbelievable-looking girls everywhere in the house, making juice and dancing and kicking up into handstands, giving you a peek of their stomachs and underwear all over the place. And it only made Andrew feel like a latter-day Umber, or like a more Jewish version of Sting. Andrew didn't care. The only 19-year-old he wanted to have sex with was himself. He wanted to go back in time and watch himself take off his clothes, so terrified of the world that he couldn't stop snarling, even when he was about to make love to someone for the first time. He and Elizabeth had known each other from the dorms. They had a few classes together, an intro creative writing class, plus the story of the dinosaurs, the science class that all the humanities kids took. And they were friends a bit. If they saw each other outside the library, they would sit on a bench and smoke cigarettes. Elizabeth was so sweet, so suburban. Andrew had liked her from the start, even before they were in the band together, and he saw what she could really do. She had none of the jaded bullshit that his friends from home had. She wasn't spoiled. She could knit. They went bowling, and Elizabeth got strike after strike. It turned out she'd been on her high school's bowling team. What kind of high school had a bowling team? Andrew thought it was possible that Elizabeth had grown up in the 1950s and been teleported to Oberlin through space and time. Lydia, on the other hand, had been as familiar as a sibling. She was from Scarsdale, which wasn't so far from the Upper East Side. She had rich parents and her own car and a credit card that she wasn't afraid to use. Just like all of his high school friends, Lydia was mean as a snake, something she'd no doubt learned from her parents. She would have been the easy choice. His mother would have loved her. Andrew hadn't been outside at 3 a.m. since Harry was a baby, and they would take walks around the block to try to coax him back to sleep, the three of them like a tribe of zombies, he and Elizabeth making shushing noises and bouncing in unison, no matter which one of them was wearing the baby and the Bjorn. Ditmas Park was always quiet, but this close to Coney Island Avenue, there were more trucks and horns, even in the middle of the night. It was true what they said about New York and sleeping. Andrew had forgotten that. He turned right on Beverly and started walking back toward Argyle. A breeze made the sweat on his forehead feel cool. Summer was the only season that mattered. The only reason for winter to exist was to increase the gratitude that Andrew felt for the month of June at this exact moment in time. He unlocked the door to his house quietly and slipped his shoes off next to the front door. Iggy Pop was asleep on the sofa, and Andrew scooped him up and carried him up the stairs. The cat arched his back into Andrew's shoulder, still mostly asleep. The bedroom door was open a crack, and Andrew could see from the hallway that Elizabeth had left her bedside lamp on. He nudged the door open a few more inches with his toe and gently set the cat down on the bed. Elizabeth stirred. She'd never been a hearty sleeper, but in the year since Harry was born, even well after he stopped waking in the middle of the night, she'd been prone to waking when cars drove past, at distant sirens, at barking dogs. He knew this only because she told him in the morning. Andrew himself was always fast asleep. It was something they fought about in a low-level way, that she was awake and he was asleep, and he had missed whatever it was that had annoyed her. Andrew slid off his shirt and his shorts. His sweat had dried to a thin film of salt. He smelled a little bit, but Elizabeth had never minded that.
Where have you been?
She asked, her voice low. She rolled over to face him.
At the yoga place. They were having a party.
Andrew sat down on his side of the bed. Elizabeth's foot peeked out from under the sheet, and he put his hand on her arch.
A party?
She narrowed her eyes at him, and Andrew tried to decide if it looked more like sleepiness or contempt. He clicked off the light.
A party.
Andrew pulled back the sheet and slid underneath. He inched closer to his wife in the darkness. Elizabeth's body felt like the ocean, vast and cool. First he kissed her arm, and when she didn't shove him away, he kissed her shoulder, and then her cheek. By the time Andrew kissed his wife's mouth, she was moving her body back and forth like a snake about to strike, and he knew that whatever happened next, it would be good. This is what it was like when they were kids, playful, nibbling. Elizabeth had been an eager lover, like the student-athlete she'd been in high school, cheeks flushed and full of energy. They rolled and stretched like two lion cubs, biting and pawing at each other's body parts. After a few minutes, they settled into a familiar position. They knew what worked. His ears were still vibrating from the party, and the room sounded like a subway platform.
Am I being too loud?
He asked Elizabeth, now flat on her back, his hands wedged under her hips, with his face between her legs.
Harry's at a friend's house, she said.
Get to work, shoving his face back against her body. Chapter 25. It was almost 2 when their feet actually touched the sand. Harry dropped the umbrella and his 2 enormous bags with a satisfying thud. Ruby leaned down to grab one of the beach towels, but Harry put out his arm to block her.
Please, he said. Allow me.
He stretched out 2 towels, stuck the umbrella in the sand between them, and then gestured for Ruby to sit. The sand was grimy, with candy wrappers and cigarette butts poking up here and there, but the water looked clear, and people were swimming. Harry's mother had always told him that New York City beaches were toxic waste zones and to be avoided at all costs, and he was glad he hadn't listened. What other things were out there, just waiting to be enjoyed? Elizabeth didn't like bacon, and so they never ate it, never. Harry was going to order a BLT with extra bacon, a BBLT, at the next possible moment.
What else is in those bags?
Harry dug around in one and pulled out a plastic pail and shovel.
Okay, Ruby said, giggling. What else?
Harry reached back down and pulled out a little insulated cooler. Inside were 2 tiny cans of champagne. It had taken Harry an hour and $40 to convince some young woman walking down Cortelyou to buy them for him. Cheers, he said, popping one open and handing it to Ruby, who took such a small sip that Harry knew she was impressed. The beach was filled with old Russian ladies holding hand weights as they walked up and down the boardwalk, avoiding the packs of guys with beards and dark sunglasses and girls wearing tiny shorts and cut-off t-shirts.
It's like an American Apparel billboard, Ruby said, but with beer and sand.
Harry couldn't tell if that was a compliment or not, but Ruby seemed to be enjoying herself, and so he didn't respond other than to nod and say,
Yeah.
They took half naps. They splashed in the water. Neither of them had a bathing suit, but it didn't matter. Ruby peeled off her dress. Her stomach was a soft, creamy brown, just like the rest of her, of course, though every inch gave Harry a new thrill. She had a perfect little outie belly button right in the middle. He could see more than the outline of her breasts through her thin, lacy bra, and when she walked away from him, toward the water, wearing nothing but her bra and underwear, Harry tried not to have a heart attack. He took off his shirt and his jeans and went in his boxers, praying the flap stayed closed. There was a burger place just on the other side of the boardwalk, and Ruby waited on their towels while Harry got them food. She licked a spot of ketchup off her hand. It was the most beautiful beach anyone had ever seen, ever, even with the planes going overhead to JFK and all the seagulls and the noise and the people. There were towels everywhere, and Dominican families, and hipsters with ironic mustaches, and old men wearing Speedos and fat women in bikinis. Harry thanked God that his parents had never moved to the suburbs, or to France, or anywhere else in the world. Ruby got the giggles after the champagne, and she let him put sunscreen on her shoulders. Harry took as long as possible, painting little designs and taking pictures with his phone before rubbing them in. The burger place was getting rowdy. On their walk back to the train, Harry and Ruby stood outside for a few minutes and watched people dance and chug beers.
I feel like I'm watching a movie, Harry said, about people who kill a hobo while they're drunk driving.
Yeah, and this is the part of the montage that we keep seeing in flashback, Ruby said.
Totally.
Harry let Ruby carry the smaller tote bag, which was less heavy now that there were no drinks and snacks in it, and he had lost a few of the beach toys, which he was fine with. They were more of a joke anyway, even though he really had liked watching Ruby build a sandcastle. It was the kind of thing he wouldn't have done for fear of looking too babyish, but Ruby obviously never worried about that. They got on the train and sat in a two-seater facing the direction they were going, with Harry against the window and Ruby on the aisle. As soon as they sat down, she let her head drop against his shoulder and put her arm around his waist.
I had a good time, Ruby said. Almost good enough to stop being mad at you for ditching our stupid SAT class this morning.
Me too,
Harry said. He sat as upright as possible and tried not to move, just in case Ruby took his fidgeting as a sign that he didn't want her there. At the next stop, someone started to sit in the seat next to them, which would have crushed Ruby's knees and made her have to shift positions, so Harry gave the best death stare of his entire life, and the guy moved away.
I feel like we must smell bad, Ruby said. No one wants to sit near us.
You do smell bad, Harry said, softly into her ear. You smell like toasted garbage.
He paused, afraid he was taking the joke too far. Everything still seemed precarious, as if Ruby might just sit up and look at him and see the truth. That he was still Harry, just Harry, no one she wanted to cuddle with on the subway. But Ruby said, and snuggled closer.
My favorite kind.
She was asleep in a few minutes and slept all the way until they had to change trains to get the queue home. When they finally got off at the Cortelyou stop, Harry was nervous. Ruby seemed rested and happy after her siesta, and the bridge of her nose was a bit burned, despite Harry's artistic efforts with the sunscreen. She bounded up the stairs and started walking toward Argyle. Harry stopped.
Hey,
he said. His voice was quiet. His mother's office was a few doors away, and he didn't want to cross in front of it, just in case she happened to be sitting at her desk.
What?
Ruby said.
This way,
Harry said, using his head to point behind them.
Okay, she said. You do know that our houses are both the other direction, right? Did you have some kind of brain injury while I wasn't paying attention?
Just trust me, he said, and started walking.
Convincing someone to buy him champagne was easy. Part B of the plan had been much, much trickier. Elizabeth kept the keys to all her properties at the office, except on weekends when she was having a few open houses. Then they lived in a zippered pouch that hung from a hook above her desk. The summer was always busy, and she was running from one place to another every day. Right now, there were a few houses a bit farther south, closer to Brooklyn College, and one on East 16th Street, a really big house that backed up onto the train tracks. She was showing the two houses on Sunday, and had shown the subway one that afternoon. Harry knew it was a risk to take the key, but he had, and the hardware store made him a copy in 5 minutes. The house's owners had moved to Florida. It was just sitting there, with their enormous old-people furniture, all dark, heavy wood and formal dining chairs. One of the smaller bedrooms had had a doll collection, which Elizabeth had shoved into a box and hidden in the basement. The subway running through the yard was enough of a handicap. They didn't need to give people nightmares, too. The porch was dark, and Ruby hesitated before following Harry up the stairs.
Whose house is this?
She was whispering.
Ours, Harry said.
He knew there wasn't an alarm, even though there were stickers on the windows and a sign in the lawn saying that there was. According to his mother, that was true for 70% of the houses in their neighborhood. Ruby hurried up behind him.
Are you serious?
She asked. But Harry had already opened the door. He pulled her in and shut the door behind them.
Whose house is this?
She asked again.
You're fucking crazy!
It was crazy, a little, and he knew that they could get into massive amounts of trouble, and his mom, too.
I told you, it's ours.
Harry wasn't sure if he could pull off mysterious, but he was having fun trying. Ruby was an inch taller than he was, maybe more. She sucked in her lower lip and looked around.
Come here, Harry said.
Where?
Ruby asked. She peeked around the corner into a dark kitchen. Here, Harry said. He took a step forward, closing the gap between them, and kissed her. Ruby was good at it, of course. They stopped and started and stopped and started and stared at each other. Her mouth opened and closed, and she flicked her tongue against his.
and Harry let out a moan that sounded like Chewbacca, and he didn't care. A SWAT team with machine guns could have broken down the door and taken him to federal prison, and he wouldn't have cared. It was 100% worth it. Ruby pulled away, took his hand, and started walking farther into the dark house.
"Let's go explore," she said.
All day long, Harry had been trying to convince his penis to stay down, to be quiet, but now it was a lost cause. His erection pressed against his jeans, and when Ruby's wrist accidentally brushed past it, she said, "Oh, hello there," which made it even bigger. If this was what came from a life of crime, Harry was ready to sign up. Chapter 26. The house on East 19th Street was going to sell fast. There were three bids after the open house, and now it was a matter of who was willing to pay. Elizabeth loved the rush of multiple bids. They were all under ask, but once buyers knew there was competition, they'd come up, and pretty soon they'd be sailing over the $2 million mark. The sellers were going to be thrilled. Their condo in Boca had probably cost under $1 million. This was the kind of money that paid for grandchildren's college educations. It wasn't all greed. She leafed through the offers on her desk at work. Deirdre looked over Elizabeth's shoulder.
"Not bad," she said.
Deirdre had chopped off her hair so that people would confuse her with Halle Berry, she said. Deirdre was a gorgeous size 14, and Elizabeth thought she actually did look like a movie star. She always wore tight sweaters the colors of emeralds and rubies. The O'Connells were dazzled by Deirdre, and Elizabeth didn't blame them. Marianne and her kids were pasty, with freckles all over, even on their arms and legs. Every one of them always looked like they had a very mild case of the chicken pox.
"It's great," Elizabeth said, holding up one of the offer sheets. "I really like this couple. Young, friendly, totally book club potential."
"Do your clients know that you're just scouting for your personal friends?"
Deirdre raised an eyebrow and then laughed.
"It only works if your friends have big checkbooks. I'd sell a house to an asshole if the check wouldn't bounce. I like 'em rich and heartless."
"You do not," Elizabeth said.
Before Deirdre could respond, Elizabeth's phone rang. "Holding for Naomi Vandenhoevel," someone said.
"Oh, shit," Elizabeth said. "Not again."
"Lizzie," Naomi said. "I'm in New York. Come and have coffee with me. Come to the office. I want to show you what we've got put together so far. I think you'll go crazy for it."
"Hi, Naomi," Elizabeth said. "How are you?"
She rolled her eyes at Deirdre. "It's nothing," she mouthed. "I'm freezing my ass off because the air conditioning in the office is on autopilot, but other than that, I'm perfect," Naomi said. "I'll email you the address. Come today. My afternoon is totally clear.
You need to see our Lydia. Ciao, ciao."
She hung up. Elizabeth set the phone back in its dock and looked at the pile of paper on her desk. She'd already done her work for the day. She'd responded to all the agents and all the clients. Everyone had their marching orders. There was more to do in the office, of course. There always was. But no one would mind if she took a few hours to go into the city. Naomi was set up in a conference room in the 50s on Fifth Avenue. Elizabeth had had to give her name to three different people sitting at desks, each of whom whispered into a phone and looked her name up on a computer. The last gatekeeper, an effete young man wearing a bow tie, told her to wait and that Naomi's assistant would be right out. A girl with a small, neat afro and bright red lipstick came swanning out a few minutes later.
"Elizabeth," she said, sounding bored. "Follow me."
They walked past stainless steel half-walls and glass-enclosed offices. Elizabeth peeked into each of them, just in case there were any visiting movie stars. The studio released prestige movies, award winners. Naomi was no slouch. Finally, they reached a door. Elizabeth saw Naomi inside, talking to another young woman, whose back was turned. Elizabeth stopped. Even from behind, she could see it. This woman, whoever she was their Lydia. And if Elizabeth didn't know better, she would think that it was her Lydia, too. The hair was just right, thick and dark and wild, as if it had never been brushed. It wasn't just fashion. Lydia didn't own a brush or a comb or a blow dryer. She'd practically set those things on fire when she moved to Oberlin for school. Scarsdale was in her rearview mirror, and she was never going back.
"Hi," Naomi said, opening her arms wide. "It's the genius."
She was taller than Elizabeth expected, with thick framed glasses and perfectly straight California blonde hair down to the middle of her back.
"Who, me?"
Elizabeth asked. She let Naomi embrace her, inhaling a cloud of sweet perfume.
Yes, you!
Naomi pulled back, holding Elizabeth's arms out.
Darcy, this is Elizabeth Marks, who wrote Mistress of Myself. She fucking wrote it. Can you believe that? Like it didn't exist, and then Elizabeth wrote down the words, and it was a fucking song.
Darcy stood up and turned around. It wasn't just her hair that looked like Lydia's. It was her eyes, her cheeks, her chin. Elizabeth understood immediately why Naomi had wanted her to come.
Oh my God, Elizabeth said.
Darcy did whatever actresses do in place of blushing. She smiled and turned her face from side to side.
I know, she said. I was literally born to do this. If I had a dollar for every person who ever told me I looked like Lydia.
You wouldn't even have half your salary for this movie. Ha!
Naomi pulled Elizabeth closer and then pushed her toward a white leather office chair. Darcy sat back down in a chair opposite Elizabeth. Elizabeth tried to look away but couldn't, which Darcy seemed to enjoy, smiling widely every time she caught Elizabeth staring.
I also found this, Naomi said. You've seen it, of course, but we did a little work. Check it out.
She grabbed a remote control and aimed it at the ceiling. Curtains slowly lowered, making the whole room dark. A screen illuminated on the far wall, and with another button push, a familiar song started to play. Kitty's mustache had made 3 music videos. They were all shot by an Oberlin kid named Lefty, whose real name was Lawrence Thompson III. He had a good camera and was in love with Zoe. She'd slept with him once or twice, Elizabeth suspected, just to keep him in the band's employ, or maybe she just let him see her naked. The first 2 videos, for Frankie's Lament, a song Elizabeth had written about their landlord, and Magic Lasso, a song about Wonder Woman, were both okay. Shot in and around campus, mostly in their grimy apartments and in empty classrooms and in the Arboretum. But for the Mistress of Myself video, they'd spent the day on a cold beach on the banks of Lake Erie. There they were, in full goth mode, all of them dressed entirely in black, standing side by side on the beach. Small snowbanks were in the foreground. It was Lefty's masterpiece, his Swedish art film.
How did you get a copy of this? Elizabeth asked.
Lydia's hair whipped around her face. They brought out some of their instruments, but Lefty decided they should leave them in the car.
It was like Wicked Game, except instead of Chris Isaak and Helena Christensen, it was all Elizabeth's screaming mouth.
At one point, Zoe lay down in the sand and rolled around. Lydia scowled. Andrew spent half the video with his back to the camera, which he claimed was his silent protest of his own role in the patriarchy. Elizabeth leaned forward. It was a close-up of Lydia's face, only it wasn't Lydia, it was Darcy.
Wait, she said. How did you...
I know, it's seamless, Naomi said. Our guys are fucking great. Once they retouched a birthmark on Angelina Jolie's boob for a 3-hour movie. They added a birthmark. She refused to do makeup, said it was something to do with child labor, or maybe with her children. Needing more time or something. Makeup can seriously take hours every day, so it was worth it to let her sleep in with all her kids and then just spend an extra million on Photoshop or whatever. It's amazing, right?
How did you get this? The original, I mean.
Elizabeth had a copy on VHS, but she'd heard through friends that Lefty had burned all his films after he decided to go into the family investment banking business, so as to set himself free from his artistic dreams. As far as she knew, hers was the only copy.
Not for nothing, Lydia's archives are in surprisingly good shape for someone who died of a heroin overdose, Naomi said. She kept everything. If you didn't know better, you'd think she was a librarian. Seriously, color-coded, in chronological order, the whole 9.
That is so strange, Elizabeth said. The Lydia I knew was a mess. She didn't even know how to balance her checkbook.
Naomi's assistant laughed.
Checkbooks, that's like a flip phone, right? But for money?
I'm serious, Elizabeth said.
Naomi nodded.
I think this is something you're really going to sink your teeth into, Darce. On the outside, she was this wild child, you know, this fuck-up. But on the inside, she was always plotting for her historical legacy.
I totally get that, Darcy said.
Elizabeth folded her hands in her lap. Her Lydia wasn't a wild child or a fuck-up. Her Lydia was self-centered and unreliable and kind of a jerk. Her Lydia had never been interested in having female friends, at least until pretty famous actresses started coming to her shows, and then she seemed to be one of the gals. But Elizabeth knew that those pictures, or her Buddhism, or whatever she called it, didn't really mean that she had changed. Elizabeth had tried with Lydia. They all had, especially Andrew. At first, it had made Elizabeth jealous. All the nights that Lydia would just happen to be curled up with Andrew on his couch, her socked feet tucked under his legs. This was after Elizabeth and Andrew had made it clear to the band and everyone that they were a real couple, and still, there Lydia would be, batting her eyelashes and asking Andrew for help putting air in her bicycle tires, as if she were ever going to ride that stupid fucking bicycle. "I want to see this movie," Elizabeth said. It would only be part of the story, of course, but maybe there was more to Lydia than she knew. If Lydia had been hoarding Kitty's mustache ephemera, then maybe she was also taking notes. Did she have diaries? For every day of her life, starting at 15, Naomi smiled. She did all the work for us, you know? Naomi uncapped a pen and handed it to Elizabeth. Need another copy of the form? Ashley? The assistant was at her side in less than a second. Elizabeth didn't think about Zoe, who she knew would be happy enough either way. For the first time in a long time, she really thought about Lydia, her long-lost, faraway friend. 27 was such a dumb time to die. But more than Lydia, she thought about Andrew and herself. The imaginary girl that Naomi had talked about, that was her, both then and now. She wanted to see herself pick up the guitar and write that song. She wanted to watch Andrew fall in love with her on the spot once he knew what she was capable of. She wanted it for both of them, and signed her name. "Give me one for Andrew, too," she said. When Elizabeth left Naomi's office, she went into the bathroom, dried off the countertop with a paper towel, and forged Andrew's messy signature, just as she'd done 1,000 times on school permission forms and credit card receipts. In their family, she was in charge of the paperwork, and so that's all she was doing, taking care of their joint business. It wasn't a big deal, just 2 seconds of ink on a sheet of paper. In another 2 seconds, she'd be in the elevator, and then she'd be in the subway, and then she'd be back in the office, and she'd fax it in, just like she faxed 1,000 other forms all day long. Nothing to see here. Nothing at all. Chapter 27. At home, Zoe's piles of stuff migrated from surface to surface, stacks of unread magazines and bobby pins, but at Hyacinth, all the counters belonged to Jane. Everything was labeled with masking tape. Everything was face out. All the salts were next to one another, fine to coarse to flakes. What people didn't understand about chefs was that it was only partially about cooking. It was about having a vision, a voice, a set of personal beliefs that were so strong that you needed to build something around them. There was literally no reason to open a restaurant if you felt like someone else was doing it better than you could. After 25 years of working in kitchens and 10 years in her own place, Jane was still sure that no one else was doing Hyacinth better than she was. The restaurant was a glorious machine, and she was its engine, the mastermind. And all she wanted was to be the mastermind of the rest of her life, too. Jane had a headache, and the headache's name was Ruby. Zoe had it worse in terms of direct combat, that was true, but they could also cuddle up and go play dress-up in Zoe's closet and talk about obscure bands that no one else had ever heard of, and it was all fine. Jane was the baddie. She was always the one who had to tell Ruby she couldn't have another ice cream, or that she couldn't force all of her preschool friends to call her the queen and do her bidding. Jane was the boss, and the boss never got to cuddle. Her own teenage years had been remarkably easy. Massapequa was a fine place to grow up. She played on all the teams and went out for pizza with her friends and had crushes on movie stars just like everyone else. Everyone was a virgin, so it didn't matter that she was a lesbian virgin. What was the difference? They all had bad haircuts and listened to Z100. The summer before she left for the NYU dorms, Jane had spent every day in the local pool, avoiding little kids because they were obviously peeing at all times. She had freckles everywhere, even between her toes. All summer, her parents treated her like she was made of glass, and she didn't understand why until it was over and they were packing the car full of pillows and boxes and books. Unlike Ruby, Jane had siblings, 2 brothers and a sister, all younger than she was. Like Ruby, Jane had had no idea what it meant for her parents to have their oldest child get ready to leave home. Leave home. It sounded so final. At the time, Jane had thought her mother was experiencing some very prolonged kind of stroke, where she was always blinking back tears and staring at Jane like she was the new episode of Dallas. but she understood it now. Children wanted to go. Children knew that they were old enough. It was prehistoric, baked-in knowledge. Only the parents still thought they were kids. Everyone else, tobacco, the voting booth, porn shops, said otherwise. Jane moved through the kitchen slowly. She rotated jars so that they were facing the right way. The bell rang over the door, and Jane looked up to see her sous chef, Clara, striding in. Clara was good, as solid as they came. Someday she'd want her own place, too. There were always more children to leave. Jane could feel herself drifting into the danger zone and cleared some space on the counter. She grabbed the bread flour and the salt and the yeast, and when Clara walked in, Jane nodded hello. Baking bread for no reason had always been Jane's favorite form of stress relief, and Clara knew well enough to go about her own work instead of asking questions. Chapter 28 Andrew was happiest when he was busy. Ever since the night of the party, he and Elizabeth had been great. It was as if she understood that he needed her to just be on his side, to support him. And he understood that she needed him to be present and supportive like always, and so they were. It didn't hurt that they were having sex more often. It wasn't quite back up to trying to conceive levels, which had been exhausting for both of them in the several years after Harry was born, when they were so intent on giving him a sibling. But it was good, really good, for people who had been together for 2 decades. It was a part of their relationship that had always been satisfying, a gentle reminder that they still knew how to do things right. Not that Andrew actually knew how often anyone else had sex. He assumed that Elizabeth knew whenever Zoe or any of her close friends had an orgasm, that she got a text message automatically. The guys weren't like that, even guys like him. Tuesday mornings were the guided meditation group. Wednesdays were yoga, Thursdays were Dharma talks, and Fridays were the cosmic trances. Andrew knew he probably wouldn't be able to go every week, not without giving Elizabeth some big drawn-out explanation. He could invite her, maybe, but she might hate it or poke fun, and then he'd have to explain to Dave how his wife wasn't into getting transcendental. Elizabeth had always been supportive of his various endeavors, but for now, he wanted to keep it to himself. Most days, Andrew walked over after Elizabeth left for work. They'd set up a wood shop in the garage, and Andrew was building some bookshelves for the rooms upstairs. Dave would wander in and out, half-dressed. Sometimes he looked like he'd just woken up, with tiny clusters of sleep still in the corners of his eyes, and sometimes he looked like he'd been up all night. They'd talk a bit, just one rung up from basic office water cooler chit-chat. Lately, Dave had been talking about a boat, a floating evolvement. In the summer, it could be here in Brooklyn. Maybe docked next to the Brooklyn Bridge, where barge music is, all decked out so the tourists want to know what's going on. And then in the winter, we sail south. Vieques, St. Martin, maybe. Dave had his arms crossed over his bare chest. He had a patch of hair in between his pecs, a fleur-de-lis of brown curls.
Do you sail?
Andrew asked. He was sanding a giant piece of wood, a shelf that would run the length of the main yoga room. He knew enough to do that. He was good with his hands. Dave had never asked if he was an expert craftsman. That wasn't the vibe. If you thought you could do it, you could do it. One of the young guys with short dreadlocks and a wide smile popped into the garage and said he had some tools in the trunk of his car, and he could help Andrew put the shelf up when he was done.
When I was a kid, Dave said. Here and there. It's all muscle memory, though.
He tapped a finger against his temple.
It's all still here.
Me too,
Andrew said. He didn't like to talk about his family, but it just came out.
I took sailing lessons every summer near my parents' house on Long Island. We spent 3 days on land just tying and untying knots before they even let us get our feet wet. I tried to teach my son, and he could not have been less interested.
Dave laughed.
You're a real polymath, man. I love it.
I don't know about that, Andrew said, but I guess I've been able to do a lot of different things.
Did you do any racing?
Sailing races, you mean? No. And my father's fantasies, yes. He would have loved a good regatta trophy or two around the house, but I was never that kind of kid. Not really. It was always a great disappointment to my parents that I was more interested in Buddhism than in country clubs.
Dave made a sympathetic,
You ever go to India?
Once, yeah, when I was 19. Andrew put the sander down.
He'd licked out a small groove by mistake, and the wood looked like a cresting wave. Dave didn't seem to notice.
I spent some time traveling around.
Jaipur, Kerala.
Nice, Dave said. That's what I'm picturing. Totally different vibe than the house. I want it to be pink, you know? Bright, colorful, like nothing else. And people could stay for a night, or maybe for a week as it sailed around, doing treatments, working with our people, like a floating retreat. Evolve boat. Boatment? Not sure what it'd be called yet.
That sounds amazing, Andrew said.
I'm glad you're into it, Dave said. We should talk more about it later.
He clapped Andrew on the shoulder.
This is beautiful, man. Wabi-sabi, right?
He nodded at the piece of wood and turned back toward the main house.
Right,
Andrew said. The garage was cool and quiet. There was some faint music coming from inside. He couldn't quite make out what it was. The Kinks? Big Star? A young couple came out of the back door with plates full of rinds and peels for the compost bin. Andrew gave a friendly salute, and they waved. What did he look like, their dad? Their cool older brother? He really didn't know. When he and Elizabeth were in their garage, sitting on their rickety wooden chairs, Andrew sometimes felt like a toothless old man in some Appalachian folk song. Elizabeth closed her eyes when she sang, and sometimes it made her look just like her mother, half-cocked on two glasses of Chardonnay, which was better than looking like his mother, whose face had been pulled back toward her ears so many times that it was a wonder she still had cheeks. There were probably guides on the internet for building a boat. Andrew could see it, the giant whale bones of the hull coming together beneath his hands. He wanted to make something that could take on the open water, something buoyant and beautiful. Chapter 29. Weekday lunches were so boring that Ruby had started drawing a graphic novel about Bingo's secret life as a hairdresser in New Jersey. Eventually, she stopped laughing at any of Jorge's jokes, and so he would just stare at her mournfully from behind the bar while muddling mint and squeezing oranges. Every time someone came in and wanted a table, Ruby would pretend to be from a different country. She was French, she was Japanese, she was Mexican. She thought at least one person would be offended and/or amused, but no one seemed to notice. Most of the customers were women in their 30s wearing clogs for no good reason, and so they were obviously not the most sophisticated audience for Ruby's performance art. Her mom was in and out, bringing in flowers for the tables and boxes of dish soap from the trunk of the car. They were acting literally ridiculous, her parents. Ruby sometimes thought about sitting them down and explaining that all they had to do was act normal and that everything would be fine. Zoe was behaving like she was on Rumspringa on steroids, all cute outfits and glasses of rosé in the middle of the afternoon, and Jane was groaning like the abominable snowman. Ruby wouldn't want to be married to either of them, but that was their problem, not hers. At this point, what was the difference between being married and divorced? They still went over all the hyacinth stuff together. The only reason that the restaurant looked half-decent was that Zoe had picked out every tile, every paint chip, every chair, every salt shaker. Running a marriage really couldn't be that different from running a restaurant. Whatever. Plus, being someone's parents meant that they would be linked for the rest of their lives anyway. There was no getting out, not really. And plus, it didn't even seem like it was really that bad. Ruby had it much worse than they did. She was probably going to have to become an organic farmer, or an exotic dancer, or something else that you only needed hands-on experience for. But hey, if they wanted to ignore her to focus on their own stupid problems, fine. She drew a hideous, glitzy ball gown, like someone on The Bachelor would wear to get out of the limo, and then added Bingo's head on top. It was 2:45 p.m. They stopped seating for lunch at 3. With only 15 minutes left, Jorge would turn people away, and she could go home. Harry said he was going to pick her up, though, and so she was going to wait until he showed. They'd hung out 3 times since the night at the house, twice just at night, on walks with Bingo, and once in the afternoon when Ruby's mothers were out. Harry was a quick learner. He seemed to know that the clitoris existed, even if he didn't know precisely where to look, and unlike some guys, he took instruction well, and wasn't offended when Ruby offered some tips. That was the one piece of sex advice her mom had given her, that it should feel good for her, too, and thank God. It was easier in the relative dark, always. That way you could fumble around and touch a new body part without fully admitting that you wanted to. Oh, was that me? Oh, was that you?
Ruby liked to take off her clothes and watch Harry's eyes get enormous. No matter how dark it was, she could still see those giant circles, like in a cartoon. It was extremely gratifying. She drew a picture of him, with flying saucers instead of eyeballs. The bell over the door rang, and Ruby looked up, expecting to see Harry. Dust held his skateboard against his chest like a shield. Over his shoulder, on the sidewalk, Ruby could see Sarah Dinnerstein, her Whitman classmate and a fellow devotee of Dust and his army of church step kids. Sarah had been pretty straight-laced until senior year, when she got her nose pierced and the inside of her lower lip tattooed with the word love. People said she was on heroin, but mostly it seemed like she was on Nico, who, like Dust, had no real school affiliation and might have been 25. No one knew for sure. In the fall, Sarah was going to Bennington. Ruby couldn't actually believe that Sarah Dinnerstein, who had 4 brain cells in her entire head, had gotten into college and she hadn't. The world wasn't fair. Sarah Dinnerstein had probably never had an orgasm. She probably thought female orgasms were a myth, like the Loch Ness Monster. "What do you want?" Ruby asked.
"I come in peace," Dust said.
He leaned against the hostess stand.
"Nico is having a thing today. All day, all night. We just came out to get some more drinks. Sarah wanted a Gatorade."
Outside, Sarah was twirling around in the sunlight. She had heavy, babyish cheeks and a dress that was too short.
"Jesus," Ruby said. "Is she tripping?"
Dust licked his teeth.
"Molly, you want some?"
The bell rang again. Harry did a double take at the sight of Dust, but kept his head high, which made Ruby happy.
"Hey,"
Harry said, nodding at her.
"Hey,"
Ruby said. She held out her fingers like a crab. Harry turned sideways to slide past Dust and let himself be pinched. Ruby slung her arm over Harry's shoulder, pulling him close.
"So maybe we'll come by, Dust."
Dust raised an eyebrow.
"Okay, man. You know where I'll be."
He dropped the board to the floor with a clatter, making Jorge jump.
"Later."
He nudged the board out the door and did an ollie on the sidewalk, to Sarah Dinnerstein's great delight.
"We're not really going to a party with Dust, are we?"
Harry asked. Ruby shrugged.
"I don't know. My friend Sarah is going, and Nico is cool."
"Okay," Harry said. "If you want to go, I'll go."
Ruby slid off the stool.
"Let's blow this pop stand."
She wanted to see if Harry's cheeks turned pink when she said the word blow, and they did. Despite having dated him for 6 months, Ruby had no idea where Dust lived, not really. His mom lived in Sunset Park, maybe, and his dad lived somewhere in Queens, but it was all sort of fuzzy. Nico, on the other hand, lived in a big house around the corner from Hyacinth, and she'd been there 100 times. Nico's house was a semi-mythical place. His parents didn't exist. There weren't bags of lentils in the cupboard or eggs in the fridge. There weren't any photographs on the walls. The curtains were always closed. Harry was walking slowly, his hair falling in his eyes. Ruby brushed her hand against his arm.
"These dudes are not my friends," Harry said. "I mean that specifically and also generally, you know, like in a philosophical sense."
"They're not that bad,"
Ruby said, even though they were actually worse than Harry could imagine. Ruby wasn't sure why she wanted to go to the party. It certainly wasn't to hang out with Sarah, whom she had never liked, and it also wasn't to make out with Dust, which is the only reason she would have gone before. It was definitely the most racially diverse social group she was a part of, which she liked. Everyone at Whitman was whiter shades of pale, as if all of them were in competition to see who could be the most clueless about their own white privilege. The church step kids were fuck-ups, but at least they weren't as bad as that. And she did enjoy the idea of making Dust jealous, and she enjoyed the idea of showing Harry what her life was like, or at least what it had been like before. Now that she had graduated, everything seemed different. She wasn't a cool fuck-up, she was maybe just a fuck-up. Maybe she wanted to go because she was afraid that she and Dust were more similar than she thought. Maybe she wanted to go because she was afraid that Harry would get scared off, and then she'd be left with Dust and Nico and Sarah, which is all she really deserved, anyway. There were a few kids smoking on the porch. Ruby knew them and waved. She reached for Harry's hand and entwined their fingers, even though holding hands in public was not something they'd done before. She looked back at him, and Harry smiled the way you smile at a YouTube video of a baby lion making friends with a baby porcupine. Like you just can't believe how good the world can be. Ruby felt instantly guilty, but it was too late, and so they walked in. Chapter 30 Dr. Amelia was on vacation. Every other shrink in the world went away in August, but Dr. Amelia went away in July. Zoe had called 3 times and left messages, and finally Dr. Amelia called her back.
Zoe, she said.
There were seagulls in the background.
I'm in Cape Cod. It's as pretty as a picture. It's the picture of health. What's up?
Zoe was under the covers. Jane was at the restaurant, and Ruby was wherever Ruby went. She'd stopped trying to keep track when Ruby was 15 and came home with a tattoo. She was a good girl, mostly, and Zoe trusted her. It was smart to give kids a little rope. That's what Oprah said. Of course, Oprah didn't have any children. Maybe she'd been talking about puppies.
Oh, nothing, Zoe said. She felt her voice begin to waver.
Jane called too, Dr. Amelia said. I'll be home in 3 weeks, so why don't you guys come and see me then?
Okay, Zoe said.
She crawled downward so that her head was closer to the foot of the bed and collided with Bingo.
I was just hoping to talk for a minute, if that's okay.
What's on your mind?
How do you know when you should get a divorce? Do you have some sort of chart? I thought I was sure, but I don't really know.
You've seen us. What do you think?
You know I can't tell you whether to stay married or not, Zoe.
More seagulls. Zoe closed her eyes and pictured Dr. Amelia in a bathing suit. It would be a colorful one-piece, maybe with a little skirt, the kind her grandmother used to wear. Dr. Amelia was probably wearing prescription sunglasses and a straw hat. Why couldn't she tell Zoe that? Everyone else was full of advice. Zoe's mother in Los Angeles, Zoe's aunts back in Michigan, people on the street. Why couldn't a therapist just give you a simple yes or no? Maybe Zoe needed a psychic instead, or one of those little paper fortune tellers. Cootie catchers. Yes or no?
Are you renting, or with friends, or what?
You know I'm not going to tell you that either.
How are the oysters?
Delicious. Dr. Amelia exhaled heavily. What's up, Zoe?
I think I'm good at my job, Zoe said. She was trying not to cry. And you know, if we get divorced, will I have to find something else to do? I'm almost 50.
The number scared her. Jane had turned 50 5 years ago, and they'd had a giant party, and everyone had stayed up too late dancing. Ruby had fallen asleep on the bar like a proper street urchin, little Brooklyn food service Eloise. But when Zoe thought about her own birthday, which was still 2 years away, she wanted to crawl into a hole and die. 50 was fine, but not if you were suddenly adrift. 50 was fine only if you were in great shape and still got kissed at least once a day.
You guys can sort out the business stuff after you sort out the marriage stuff. It doesn't have to all happen at once.
No one is going to get excommunicated. One thing at a time. When was the last time you signed a really complicated contract? Divorce is a business, too.
But how do I know if that's really what I want?
Zoe was whispering. She wanted to ask Elizabeth if she ever felt this way around Andrew, but saying the words out loud seemed cursed. Like if you'd ever even thought them, if you'd let them pass through your brain and then lips, then your marriage was doomed. She didn't want to be doomed, and she didn't want to admit to Elizabeth that she was doomed.
Do you love your wife?
Zoe's ear and cheek were slick with sweat from the phone.
Of course I do. We have a daughter. We have a life. We just never have fun, you know? I feel like I have a roommate, and I have to do her laundry.
Sometimes when Jane kisses me, I forget that she's allowed to do that, like she's a homeless person on the bus or something.
Maybe you should try having some fun, Dr. Amelia said.
Zoe wiped the sweat off her face.
Yeah, she said. Any suggestions?
She poked her head out of the covers, knocking Bingo onto the floor.
When was the last time you went on a date? Dr. Amelia said.
Maybe you need to kick the snow off your boots. Kick the tires. See if you can pump a little air into the bicycle.
I gotcha, Zoe said. We'll book an appointment when you're back. Thanks for calling. I'm sorry to bug you on your vacation.
That's what telephones are for. It's fine. You take care.
And then Dr. Amelia was gone, and Zoe and Bingo were alone in the house again. There was a thump downstairs, and Zoe called out, "Hello?" But no one answered. The house had its own problems. Chapter 31 Elizabeth hadn't seen Iggy Pop all afternoon. She'd been in and out, into the office, to the grocery store, to the coffee shop, but Iggy usually rotated through his sleeping spots throughout the day, and so it didn't seem strange until she realized that it had been nearly all day. Harry was playing a video game in the living room, an SAT book splayed open on the coffee table.
"Iggs," she said. "Iggo Piggo? Pop Pop?"
Elizabeth walked in circles around the kitchen.
"Have you seen the cat?"
she asked. Harry shook his head without taking his eyes off the screen.
"Hmm,"
Elizabeth said. She checked all the beds and the bathroom sinks. Sometimes when it was hot, Iggy went from sink to sink, trying to stay cool by pressing his body against the porcelain. Andrew was at evolvement again. Elizabeth wasn't interested in being a nag. She loved that Andrew was in touch with his feelings. She never wanted a husband like her father, who could have been on fire and wouldn't have called for help. But she didn't love that Andrew seemed to have chosen to be an intern at a yoga studio instead of finding an actual job, even if that actual job had been an internship as a woodworker. Andrew had never cared about money. He'd never had to. But for most of their adult lives, he had at least respected the appearance of having a job. There were tons of kids at Whitman in similar situations, the children of actors and hedge funders, the grandchildren of people whose names were on the sides of public buildings. Brooklyn wasn't the same as it had been when they'd moved, a city next door, with its own rhythms and heartbeats. Now it was all Manhattan's spillover. The Russian oligarchs were buying up Tribeca in the West Village, and so Brooklyn was the next best thing. It was her job to support this, but Elizabeth didn't like it. She would have been happier making smaller commissions and keeping the borough full of middle-class families. She'd sold so many houses to public school teachers, Center Slope townhouses, and those houses were now worth absolutely stupid amounts of money. Sometimes she thought about moving upstate, somewhere pretty along the Hudson. Maybe when Harry graduated, she and Andrew could cash out for good, sell the house, sell the life. If they weren't in the city, then maybe Andrew wouldn't ever have to pretend to have a job again. He could just go on meditation retreats and build sculptures or throw pottery or take taekwondo classes. She could sell country houses to the rich people who were buying $2 million houses in Brooklyn. She'd ask the O'Connells to let her open a branch office in Rhinebeck. Harry could spend summers at home, living in the apartment over the garage. What did it mean about their self-worth if they needed to be in the city for no reason? Was she that afraid of what her friends would think of her, if they'd say she was a quitter? Was she a quitter?
Mom?
Sorry, what? Elizabeth blinked. Harry was staring at her. The scene on the screen paused with his detective frog in mid-jump.
Do you want help looking for the cat? It's going to get dark soon.
Elizabeth rubbed her hands together. Yes, oh, sweetie, yes, let's do that. Can you check the basement? I'll do one more search down here and then maybe we'll walk around the block. Iggy Pop wasn't supposed to go outside. There were feral cats in the neighborhood and he was no fighter. But the back screen door was easy enough to shove, even for a cat. He'd gotten out a few times before, and they'd always found him stalking around the flower beds in the yard, a determined look on his face. Elizabeth opened and shut cupboards in the kitchen and peeked under the dining room table.
"Not in the basement," Harry said, coming up the stairs.
"No," Elizabeth said. "I didn't think so." They started in the garden, Elizabeth walking clockwise and Harry counterclockwise. No sign of Iggy. "Let's walk around the block," Elizabeth said. They walked down the driveway to the sidewalk and turned right, checking under the parked cars and in the flower beds. Harry needed a haircut. His curls were starting to creep down his neck, the way they had when he was a baby. Elizabeth resisted the urge to reach out and put her finger inside one of the ringlets.
"So are you spending time with Ruby?"
Since the eBay incident, Harry hadn't mentioned her, but Elizabeth saw his phone light up more than usual, and then his whole face, and so she knew that Ruby was still hovering around. She wasn't against it, not really. She loved Ruby. She loved Zoe. She loved that Harry was spending time with a girl, whether what they were doing was romantic or platonic, or most likely somewhere in that giant, hazy in-between zone.
"I guess," Harry said. "Yeah, we hang out. I mean, after our SAT class and stuff, sometimes."
"That's nice," Elizabeth said.
She didn't want to press. She had never once talked to either of her parents about her love life as a teenager or as an adult. When she and Andrew had decided to get married, her father had made a joke about the marital bed,
and Elizabeth had felt nauseous for days. It was Harry's business. Ruby was a little bit wild, but Elizabeth very much doubted that her sweet son was up to Ruby's romantic standards.